just adding and adding. Wayne was Spank's hookup from the airport. Since he could fly for free, he started coming out to join us on weekends. The thing we liked most about him was that he never kept his money in the bank. He kept it all in his pocket. This made him the ATM for everyone on the road. Hey, Wayne, give me $100. At the end of the weekend, Wayne would get his cash back from Nate. Eventually, he wanted to get more involved. Hey, Kev, man, you know how you always go into clubs after these shows? Hey, I don't mind making sure that you guys are all safe and keeping people off you. You know, just in case things get crazy, I can handle it. Now, on a particular night when Wayne said this, we were at the Improv in Fort Lauderdale, and there were probably 100 open seats in the house. There was nothing I needed to be protected from other than my own spending habits. On the other hand, Wayne was a big guy. He was fat. I'll be honest. He was fat. So I don't want you guys to think he was big, like, and in shape big. He was fat. He was a fat, big guy. Maybe this would be something that could keep Nate from trying to pretend like he was my security. I told you guys earlier on, Nate tried to do everything. At every club I went to, I had an out-of-shape middle-aged man walking behind me with his stomach poking me on my goddamn back and one hand thrust into his pocket like he was packing. Nate, what are you about to do? You gonna shoot that man with your fingers that you got balled up in your pocket? What are you doing? Back the fuck off, Nate, so people can stop thinking that I'm a goddamn human centipede. Jesus. Everyone in the group liked to keep me in check. But Wayne more than anyone had no problem telling me, hey man, go sit your stupid ass down. So I figured he'd be better at the job just because he was clear when he spoke. Though I didn't need any security, having a bodyguard made it look like I was succeeding. And in entertainment, perception is reality. So I told him, okay, yep. I probably do need that. I can break off a couple of dollars and pay you for security. Wayne eventually became my travel agent too. One day, we were checking into a hotel and I overheard Spank saying, yo, Wayne, stop being a bitch and tell him, man. Wayne didn't say anything. So Spank did. Hey, Kev, Wayne got fired from the airport. Wayne says, yeah, man. You bitches was calling me like every hour into my shift nonstop every motherfucking day. So yeah, I got fired. I'm spending all my goddamn time helping y'all. Nah, Wayne, tell him how long you been fired for. Wayne wouldn't say anything else. But Spank ratted him out again. By the way, everybody knows that Spank can't keep a secret. Spank is the one person in our crew that you can't say shit to. Spank is going to tell. 100%. If anything gets out, everybody always looks at Spank. Spank, who you fucking say something to? What? All I did was tell the radio station what we were talking about. Fucking Spank. Spank's had it been 3 months. Wayne's car had been repossessed. I've been paying Wayne just $200 a week, so I have no idea how he was surviving. I said, come on, man. I got you. I said, we'll figure it out. And now there were 7 of us, Plastic Cup Boys. Chapter 77. You heard it before. Now hear it without jokes. The one time we needed Wayne as security, he hurt us a lot more than he helped. We were in Austin. I had flown Tori out to spend the weekend. The guys weren't happy about this, by the way. You know, there were times when Tori and I would be in the middle of a full-blown screaming match as I was waiting to go on stage. I'd tell her, wait a minute. I'd do my set, then I'd walk off stage, and we would pick up right where we left off. True story. We would pause the argument. You just fucking wait. Let me go up here and do my set. Boop, 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 boop. Laugh, laugh, laugh. Come off. Motherfucker, let me tell you something else. Right there. A local promoter and his girlfriend took us to 6th Street after the show to do a club crawl. And while we were drinking, his girlfriend began flirting with Wayne. The promoter got mad and took off without her. She started asking us for cocaine. Quick moment. I don't do drugs. Okay? I don't do drugs. I don't do drugs. I don't do drugs. Okay, I just wanted to get that out the way. Wait, I don't do drugs. So, I explained that, hey, drugs weren't our thing, man. Unless she was looking for Tylenol. I got a batch of that in my fucking book bag. In which case, you know, we went with extra strength, too. Because you don't want the fucking weak stuff. You gonna get Tylenol. We gonna hit you with the hard shit. I'm gonna get rid of whatever you got. As we headed out to another club, Tori said she had to use the bathroom. Now, we were just in that place for about 2 hours. But the minute we leave, you gotta go. I don't understand that. We were just in a fucking... You could have went there. You wait until it's time to walk out the door to go to the bathroom. All women do this, by the way. It's a fucking national thing. Like, women wait until it's time to depart to say, oh, wait, I should go to the bathroom. Oh, okay, yeah, let's do it now when we're fucking leaving and walking down a bunch of steps as a crowd of people are coming. Yeah, let's go back the other way. Goddamn women. Who I love. Sometimes. It's always a bad sign when you get upset at your wife for something that you wouldn't get upset at anyone else about. You know, Tori and the cokehead girlfriend ran to a bar across the street to use the bathroom, and Nate went to go get the car while we waited for him. When Nate pulled up, Tori and her new friend still hadn't come back. We checked the bar they going into. They weren't there. I called Tori. No answer. We fanned out to search for him. I walked into a bar a little ways down the street and spotted the girls. A tall, bearded 50-year-old dude who looked like a bar manager was trying to kick him out. I found out later it was because Cokie had been asking everyone for drugs. I ran over. I said, hey, man, my fault, dude. I'm sorry. That's my wife. I got her. He shouted to the point where the veins in the folds of his neck began bulging. They need to get the fuck out of my place now. I said, hey, chill, man. I got him. Okay, the drunk. The girls were annoying. I mean, look, even to someone who wasn't married to one of them. We just having fun. What's the problem? The manager grabbed Tori's arm as she tried to walk deeper into the bar. Oh, you can't do that. That's why I shoved him. Shoved him away from him. I said, hey, man, I said I got it. Get your fucking hands off my lady. Two security guys appeared out of nowhere, instantly put me in a full Nelson. Or a half Nelson. Some sort of a Nelson. I don't really know the breakdown of the Nelson thing. I don't know who he was or why people refer to this move like that. But you know the thing I'm talking about. Okay? Whoever he is, he just had it out for me that night. This Nelson guy wanted me dead. He's probably part of that Jones family. When you think about it, you know, keeping up the Joneses, the four Nelson. Who the fuck are these people? We've never met them. There's no photo surfacing around. Whatever. All right, so the guys carry me out of the bar. They carry me by my neck, ripping my shirt in the process, and then they held me up in the air. Moments later, the manager burst through the door with Tori, pushing my face out of the way with the palm of his hand. My friend saw what was going on, ran over. Get your fucking hands off him. Yo, I'm good. Just let me go. The security guys released me, but I wasn't good. I wasn't good at all. I walked away as calmly as I could. I was pretending. Then I quickly pivoted and ran back towards the bar where the manager was still holding on to Tori. His eyes widened as he saw me coming for him like a young pygmy dynamite. Now, if I ever get into wrestling, young pygmy dynamite is going to be my ring name. It's a good name. Coming to the ring, everybody make some noise for young pygmy dynamite. That's how it was sound. He put his head down as if he was going to tackle me. So I stopped running and boom, hit him. Then I got a few more shots in. Pat, 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 pat. It was a rare opportunity because I never hit anyone whose head was at a lower level than mine. Usually I got to swing up, you know, like I'm saluting or something. In summary, I whipped the ass of a 50-year-old man. Now, I know it's pathetic. I know. So far in this book, I've only been in fights with women, children, and an old white man. But if young pygmy dynamite actually was in a wrestling league, he'd definitely be the villain. Yeah, definitely. I would carry a crushed up extra stem Tylenol in my tights. I would probably throw it in my opponent's eyes when he least expected it. Extra stem Tylenol! Ah! That's how I would fucking take you down. The security guys went to go get the cops. My crew turned and we ran. I dashed to the SUV and I yelled, Nate, let's go! We did a head count, made sure we weren't missing anyone. Then I noticed the car wasn't going anywhere. Fucking Nate was sitting there adjusting the mirrors. Fuck it, Nate! Just go, please! He flipped on the turn signal, then sat there waiting to pull out. He eventually crept into the traffic lane, driving like an old man, which I guess he technically was. I haven't seen a car go this slow since I last took Heaven on a kid's ride at the amusement park. Suddenly, I spot a faint flash of red lights in the rearview mirror. Everybody chill. I turn around to see two cops on bicycles pedaling in the distance and gaining on us. With Nate at the wheel in 6th Street traffic, we were no match for him. Pulled out my wallet, removed all my money, handed the bills to Spank in the front seat. If I go to jail, yo, just come get me. Here's everything I got. No matter what happens, none of y'all know shit, okay? The police pedaled up alongside us, asked us to pull over. Cop came up to the window. Hey, they're telling me there was a fight going on back there. Do you guys know anything about that? Spank said, I don't know nothing about that. Cop looked at somebody else and said, how about you? You know anything about this fight? Nate goes, nope. I don't know what you're talking about. The cop then looked into the back seat. You in the back seat. You know who was fighting? Wayne goes, we was all fighting. Jesus fucking Christ. Everybody, Wayne, what the... Why, Wayne, cop? Get out the car. Everybody, out the car. Wayne, what? We was. I just told him what was going on. I didn't know that y'all didn't want what? After that, I'm gonna be honest with you, Wayne was dead to me as a security guard. The officer told us to sit on the curb. His partner sauntered over, looked at me, and exclaimed, hey, wait, look, it's Kevin Hart. I could tell right then that he was a crooked cop. Because the only way that he would have recognized me from that movie was if he'd seen the bootleg. He was a bootleg supporter. Look, man, I told him, I said, none of them did nothing. The situation is that my lady here, she was drunk, she was asked to leave the bar, and as she was coming out, someone put their hands on her. There was a little tussle. It's not, then why's your shirt ripped? My lady did that. The guy back there says, he says you assaulted him. What? Nah. Right now, look, it was time to show this fan some acting. That's what I decided to do. I said, why would I assault that man? Huh? Look, why would I put myself in that situation? You know who I am. I wouldn't risk my career like that. All right, stay right here. He walked away, spoke with his partner, then they talked with the manager and came back. Listen, it sounds like the situation got out of hand. If you go over there and apologize to that man, we're good. I'm not going to cause you any trouble. I walked over. I apologized sincerely, shook his hand, apologized again. Realized that he was probably more like 60 after I shook his hand. Really got a good look at his skin. He was older. So I apologized one more time. Then I returned to the car. All right. The cop waved us off. Y'all stay out of trouble, man. That was the moment I knew that I was making progress in the world. I was officially famous enough to get out of going to jail, but not so famous that I was taken to jail as an example. I also had new material. I figured that the story would be good for at least 5 minutes of the hour that I was putting together for my next special. Though when I added it to the set, I conveniently left out the fact that the bar manager I punched was pushing 60. First of all, let me just explain something real quick. When I say I hit him, I hit him. It was a good uppercut, and I hit him like 3 jabs. That's when my friends realized that I could fight, by the way. Nobody knows that about me. I can fucking fight. I really can. So. Just let that stay in your head. In case you want to fuck with me. Knock your old ass out. Now, if you're like 25 or 30, I don't want to fight you. Your energy's probably way different than the older guy. I only like to fight old people. Okay, that's it. All right, I'm done. Chapter 78. It took me half a damn hour to come up with a way to explain why it's important to communicate well. So, I hope I communicated it well. Otherwise, it'll be kind of ironic. After the Austin incident, I sat down with Wayne. I said, look, Wayne, you're no goddamn security guard. Wayne, you're a good guy, but you're not the protector. You can't be security no more. He said, thank you, brother. I'm tired of standing in the corner while all y'all over there having fun. I'm gonna figure out some better shit that I can do for you. He thought about it for a moment, then he said, you know what? I'm more of a guy who can help with business. I mean, after some of these shows, what if we did after parties? I find a club, broker the deal, and just set everything up. From that day forward, Wayne and Nate started arranging events at nightclubs after the shows, and we worked to bring over as much of the audience as possible. Club kicked us a commission off the cover charge, and I divided the money among the guys. With the picture business, the CD and the DVD business, and now the after parties and t-shirts, which we could finally afford to get made, the money I made from the incidentals was starting to match the money I got from performing. Wayne soon took over on the promotions front. MySpace was dying, but Twitter and Facebook were coming up. So we started doing guerrilla marketing on those networks. Wayne and I would sit there with our laptops open, copying and pasting messages to random comedy fans in each city on our itinerary, introducing myself and letting them know that I'd be in town. Out of 100 people, 10 will reply and say, sure, I'll come down and check you out. And that was 10 more people than we had before. Wayne helped me improve the flyering process as well. By the time we arrived in each city, we had identified every mall within a 20-mile radius of the club. We made sure to tell anyone we gave them to our name and say, hey, let the person at the box office know that I sent you. At first, it was just to see which one of us had the most charm. But soon it became a way to find out someone's area of strength. Then we could say, hey, you got to go talk to those girls because you've been doing well with them. You're great with the guys, so go to the barbershop. And you? Well, I don't know. I don't know what you're great at. So you should just go to the dog park or something. That's where you should go get people. At one point, I came up with the idea of giving people $5 off their ticket if they came to the club with the flyer. I figured the club would take that amount out of my share. However, I forgot to pass this information on to the venue. So, dozens of people showed up that night with the flyers and started arguing when the person at the box office wouldn't give them the discount. The manager ended up honoring the agreement, but he was pissed at Nate and me. This incident taught me one of the most important business lessons there is. Communication is the key that unlocks a plan. See, everyone should know your intentions at all times, as well as any changes to them. A good idea with bad communication is as useful as a phone with a dead battery. In each city, we were able to see the results of our work. The first time we performed there, we sell out Fridays and Saturdays, but the Thursdays and Sundays, they were light. So the next time, Thursday would be sold out too, but Sunday was still light. By the third visit, every night would be sold out. Online, our work was also paying off. I'll never forget being in Cincinnati when I first hit 10,000 followers on Twitter. Holy shit. 10,000? It felt like such a huge achievement. I mean, I was walking on air all day. As our reputation grew with the clubs, Wayne got the comedy promoters to find a street team for us. We'd send them 500 flyers in advance, and they'd plaster the city with them. It cost us a few $100s, but it saved us a lot of time that we then used to promote the shows online. See, it was on these tours that the entrepreneur in me was born. When I was on my own, I knew that whatever ups and downs occurred, I'd survive. But now that I had people whose salary I was paying, I had to think differently. I couldn't fuck around with their rent and car payments. I had to learn the crafts of business, entrepreneurship, and brand building as well as comedy. Figuring all this out early in the age of social media, before people started brand building on the day their parents gave them the first phone, that gave me a huge advantage over other comedians. There was also another lesson. When I increased my overhead by hiring all these guys whose expenses I couldn't afford, everyone said I was being stupid and wasteful. But as an unexpected consequence, this expansion ended up increasing my personal profit. Because now it wasn't just me working to survive, it was a whole team working to survive. See, they believed that I would grow and knew that as I did, that they would grow too. A team is going to survive better than an individual, just as a team is always going to beat an individual in a sport. That is, in a team sport. I'm not sure how that would work in an individual sport. In fact, you know what? Let's just forget I mentioned that. That's one of those bad runs. Look, they're all not going to be good. Okay. Some of them are going to fall. That's one that fell. But what's the good thing about falling? You get back up. And right now, I'm back on my feet. The point is, it's all about community, people. We are stronger together. The seven of us have gone to every comedy club in the country. It didn't matter if it was good, bad, or sketchy. When we got to the last club, Nader Berkowitz would call the first ones that we'd gone to and book them all over again. We did that 4 times in a row until we built up a fan base so large that the clubs couldn't hold them anymore. The long road, it turns out, was tens of thousands of miles. 4 times around the country. What finally ended up launching my career, though, was something that I never would have predicted. In fact, it was something that I didn't even want to do. Chapter 79. Sometimes you have to say yes to the things you want to say no to so you can raise yourself to a place where you can get to say no to more things. In this period, I was invited to perform a 15-minute set for a comedy event that Shaquille O'Neal was putting together in Phoenix during the NBA All-Star Game. The night was being filmed for Showtime, which normally would have been a good thing, but I was still building my next special, Seriously Funny. If my new material was on Shaq's All-Star Comedy Jam special and the DVD, then I wouldn't be able to use it for my special and my DVD. Now, I just might pass on it. That's what I told Dave. I mean, he thought that was fine. I'd done a few other stand-up comedy showcases on TV. Comic View, One Mic Stand. I mean, they hadn't done much for me, so we figured this show probably wouldn't do anything either. But the producers kept coming back to us, eventually offering me the headlining slot. I folded and I agreed to participate. I don't really want to do it, so you can come with me. That's what I said to Harry. Maybe we can find a way to make something out of it, you know? Get some new material or something. I don't usually complain. I don't drag my feet. I don't resist things that I have to do. This wasn't me. But I was worried that it would push back the timeline for my next special. I mean, it might take 4 months to get another good 15 minutes together. Just before the show began, Harry and I stood backstage with the other comedians who were performing. Tommy Davidson, D. Ray Davis, and Cedric the Entertainer. It was stunning to me and probably to them that I was actually the headliner. Harry and I went back and forth, unsure whether to give away some of the seriously funny material or to try to get away with using something from Grown Little Man. The room was packed with celebrities and each comic who went on destroyed. 15 minutes before my set, I still had no idea what I was going to say on that stage. I huddled up with Harry and said a small prayer that I started reciting before each performance. Thank God for the moment and the blessings. As we leaned into each other, Harry asked, what material are you most comfortable doing? Well, all I've been doing lately is just the seriously funny jokes. All right, so just do those. We can write new material for the special. Yeah, fuck it. You're right. We're just going to say, fuck it. Let's write some new jokes. All right, I'm going to go out there and give him the best shit that I got, man. It was another right or left moment, and thankfully, I went right. By the time I danced on the stage, the audience was so heated up that the room exploded after every phrase I spoke. I fed off that energy and grew larger and louder. When I hit the 15-minute mark, I wasn't ready to stop, so I pressed on. I love the fact that my wife is crazy. I don't want a happy woman. Then I went on for another 10 minutes on my relationship and relationships in general. When I was done, I burned through 23 minutes of seriously funny. But just about all the people in that room were out of their seats giving me a standing ovation that didn't seem to end. When the All-Star special aired and the DVD came out with a relatively unknown comedian headlining after all these amazing performers, people started investigating. Oh, that motherfucker, that's funny. What did they say his name was? Kevin Hart. I ain't never heard of him. Oh, wait a minute, he's the guy from Soul Plane. Oh, yeah, wait, what else has he done? I think he got his own special. I'm going to go back and watch that shit. In the last year, I'd done Comic View, One Mic Stand, Grown Little Man, and more than a dozen films and television shows that I hoped would launch me. But everything hurt me, did nothing, or just helped me a little. For some reason, this appearance, the only one out of all these that I didn't want to do, became the thing that propelled me to the next level. When I did club shows afterwards, I felt a heightened sense of anticipation in the audience. They weren't just seeing a comedian that they were curious about or heard about from a friend or recognized from a cult movie anymore. They were seeing Kevin Hart. That was the moment that gave me the right to refer to myself in the third person. Because that was when a public Kevin Hart was created, who is pretty much the same as private Kevin Hart, which now that I think about it means that I don't really have that right. But writing me above would look even more egotistical. So that's why I didn't. You know what? Fuck it. God, I'm doing it again. That's my goddamn name. I can say it all I want. I don't gotta explain myself or why I'm saying it the way I'm saying it. Not that y'all asked me, because you didn't ask me to, but some of you were thinking it. And you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about you. The one that's listening to what I'm saying. And a lot of people are listening, so now you thinking, is he talking to me? So technically, I tricked you. It's called a Jedi mind trick. So, now everything I said makes sense. In the end, I didn't regret giving away my material at all. In fact, it was one of the best, worst decisions I've ever made in my career. I've learned so many valuable lessons in my life, and this was one of the most important. Do your best, always. Because you never know who's watching. As Curtis Mayfield once said, it may not come when you want it to, but when it does, it's right on time. That was either Curtis Mayfield or Bullwinkle. One of them, shit, I got my facts mixed up. One of them said it, though. Chapter 80! 8 is my favorite number! I deserve everything that happens to me in this chapter and more. When you're touring and you're in an unhappy marriage, your resistance to temptation is low. You know that, your buddies know that, your woman knows that. So, instead of her being your wife, she becomes your parole officer. Her whole life becomes about trying to find out the truth. This can only go in one or two directions. Either she's right and she investigates you until she gets proof, or she's wrong and she investigates you until she drives you away. Either way, you both lose. As for the cheater who hasn't been caught, a psychological miracle happens. The more he tells lies, the more he believes them. His secret life moves into a compartment in his mind that's locked and sealed when he's with his wife. All this is my way of explaining that when I denied seeing other women to Tori, I actually believed what I was saying. This may seem hard to buy, but because the facts that Tori was saying were wrong, I was able to be honest with her on a technical level. See, here's how that worked. You're not doing the show. You just sneaking out with one of your side bitches for the weekend. Now, let me tell you guys what the actual facts are, okay? Fact number one, I'm doing the show. I'm 100% doing a show. Fact number two, none of my side bitches are coming to this particular show. Fact number three, the reason why none of them are coming is because I invited three random women online. Those are facts. So I told Tori, yo, you're crazy. I'm doing a fucking show. I take a picture of the damn marquee and I send it to you to prove it. Now, is that real honesty? Of course not. But everything I told her was true. So the fact that she distrusted me made me feel like I was a victim in the situation. Then I go to the show and feel justified in hooking up with one of those three women because I deserved it after being so mistreated. The lengths that the human mind will go to deceive itself are incredible. Some people know how to hit the brakes before things spiral out of control. But I was not one of those people. I had never gone to college, so being on the road was my way of making up for it. I basically got a dual degree in business education and performing arts while living in a mobile fraternity. See, once when I was in Louisville, Tori and I were arguing on the phone about where I was the night before and what I was doing. I was with Naeem. You wasn't with no goddamn Naeem. I was. I called Naeem right now and prove it. I dialed Naeem on three-way. Naeem's not stupid. The moment I opened my mouth, he should have knew exactly why I was calling and who was listening silently. Naeem, fucking please. Real quick, okay? Just tell me what we were doing last night. Hey, man. Kev, I don't like getting in the middle of this relationship stuff. Don't be lying to Tori saying that you was with me ever. What? Why are you treating her like this? Wait a minute. Nah, man. You gotta stop. Don't be making her look stupid when she's alone out here in L.A. Whose fucking side are you on, Naeem? I hung up the phone on both of them. Fucking Naeem. Why does he gotta be so damn nice and honest? And shit, if he's nice and honest, what does that make me? I called Tori back. I still didn't come clean. I spun and elaborated the story about getting drunk, passing out in the street, getting sick all over myself, and being too embarrassed to tell her. Oh, she didn't believe a word of that. But she didn't have hard evidence that it wasn't true either. All she knew was that I lied and that she was sick of it. So was I. I mean, all this time I've been making Tori into some sort of demon in my mind, but I was the one. I was the one that was cheating, lying, leading a double life, putting my friends in an uncomfortable position of covering for me. I was the demon. Fortunately, the proof Tori needed to unmask me would come soon enough. At a show in Columbus, Ohio, I spotted a woman who had one of the best bodies I'd ever seen. Through my set, she looked at me like a python waiting to strike a duck and swallow it whole. Later that night, I discovered that she had a snake tattoo on her back. I also discovered that she could swallow things whole. The next afternoon, she emailed me, oh my God, this is amazing. Did you feel what I felt? An hour later, she sent a longer email about how this was destiny and we were meant to meet. For 3 days straight, she emailed love letters, sexual fantasies, even a photo of her with a dildo in her mouth, which was amazing. I showed the email to Naeem. Hey, man, I think I might have a stalker. Did you sleep with her? Maybe. But that's what you get. What? Naeem, what is your deal? See, you think these girls like you for you. Look at her body. Now look at yours. These girls are sleeping with you because they're obsessed with your fame, Kevin. Hey, wait. Does that mean I'm a star? Is that what you're saying right now, Naeem? No, man, it means you're stupid. First of all, Naeem's level of honesty was just way too much. He didn't need to say everything he said. I emailed her back and I said something like, hey, you being a little intense. Maybe you should just chill out a little. In retrospect, I should have said, I'm falling so deeply in love with you that I don't know if I can see you again because I'm scared of getting hurt. Because instead of chilling out, she found Tori's social media profile, sent her a message, and then emailed me a copy. You should know that your husband and I made love and are in love. He's not who you think he is. You don't mean anything to him. What the fuck just happened? Jesus Christ. She went on to provide details about the night, the date, the time, the name of the hotel, my room number, things I said, things I did. Things you don't want your wife imagining. Oh, I lost my shit. There were so many specific facts that there was no way for me to get out of this. My phone rang. It was Tori. I let it ring through the voicemail. When I finally got myself and my story together, Tori wouldn't pick up my call. I took a moment to figure out which one of my friends had any patience left for cleaning up my messes. Hey, Spank, do me a favor and call Tori right now. Don't ask why, just do it. She find out? Look, man, I'm not paying you to ask questions, Spank. Was that girl with the snake tattoo? You're killing me here. Was it worth it? Just give me the fucking phone, Spank. Jesus Christ. Tori started going off as soon as she picked up. He shouldn't have crossed me. I'm gonna make him sorry. I spoke up. I own what I did and I apologize. Not because I'm a good person, in case anyone actually still thinks that at this point. But it was because I had no other option. Tori laid it to me for the next hour straight. I will never forget the last word she said. You should never trust a woman with a snake on her back. From that point on, I had clarity on how to deal with women on the road. A few people have a snake on their back that you can see. But most people with a snake have one that you can't see. You don't know what someone is hiding. Shit can go bad at any time for any reason. So before getting into any situation, it's necessary to think, what are the worst possible consequences that could happen because of this? See, if you can live with them, then go have fun. But if you can't, then back the fuck away from the snake. Chapter 81. I consider myself a smart person. I even call myself a genius in the second chapter title. So why have I been so stupid about this one thing? Even you, who are not as smart as me, knew I should have done this like 100 pages ago. Any small shred of hope I used to cling to, thinking that I could force my marriage to work, disappeared after the snake incident. Tori now knew she wasn't crazy and felt justified in treating me like the lion sack of shit that I was. I felt guilty for what I'd done, and I took it without protest. Of course, now, I hadn't felt guilty when I was doing it. It was just when I got caught. So it's not like I really had a conscience in the situation. If I had, I wouldn't have cheated in the first place. At this point, I should have just left. I've been over the marriage for years, and this would have been a good excuse to get out of it. But I couldn't bring myself to cut the cord because I didn't want to abandon the kids. I didn't want to lose the days I set aside each week to come home and spend time with them. So I stayed and I just tried to appease Tori. I no longer argued with her. I no longer disagreed with her. I became not a man but a pacifier. The argument we had for so long, you get to go out and live your life while I'm stuck here. I got to work to support this family. Now all that changed after I was caught cheating. It was now clear to her that I wasn't always working, so she wanted me on a tight leash. She wanted to be on the road with me more. She wanted me to help her pursue her dream. Now, of course, I'll support you. I mean, what's your dream? I want to be a stand-up comedian. What? I've watched you do it for so long, and I'm funny. I know I'd be great at it. It takes time. Are you going to help me, like you said, or not? Yeah, well, you're very aggressive. You know what? I'll support you. Good. God knows you've given me more than enough material. She got to work. She wrote jokes. Went to open mics to perform. And then she spoke the most terrifying 5 words I've heard in our entire relationship. Even more terrifying than, I'm going to kill you. I want to open for you. That got another, wait, what? That's 2 wait, what, so you know the situation has gotten, it's serious. But I was a pacifier now. So I let her open a show for me. She got some laughs. She even did something on stage that I couldn't. Impersonations. Afterwards, I gave her some notes to help her out. But she wasn't interested in that kind of support. I don't need any advice. I'm not trying to be you. You do your thing and I'll do my thing. I'll be successful my own way. You just watch. After I had gone out of my way to get her a spot, her words felt like a slap in the face. Though I understood that sometimes when advice comes from a person you're in a relationship with, it sounds more like criticism. From then on, pretty much all Tori talked about was how she was going to make it as a stand-up and get a television show and write a book and do it all much quicker than my dumb self. She soon started trying to insert herself into any opportunity I had. The Tori who moved to L.A. had no interest in being famous. I didn't notice Tori. At one of my shows, a couple walked over and asked for my autograph. Y'all want this motherfucker's autograph? That's what she said. He ain't shit. A week later, I returned home from a run of shows and spent time with the kids, and I saw Tori in the living room with a stack of scripts. Hey, I need you to read these, and then let me know your favorite. And if you agree to do it, then they'll put me on a show too, right? In Hollywood, I met many sicko fans who tried to befriend and use me to get opportunities, not knowing how hard I worked to get those opportunities for myself. I looked at my wife and it felt like she had turned into one of those people. She may have hated me as a person, but suddenly she loved me as a vehicle. Then one day my father called. We didn't talk about anything of substance. He just went on about how mom had raised me too soft and that he wished he'd stuck with her so he could have made me a man. I replied that I was happy with how things worked out. If he stayed with my mother, and they had fought like they did throughout my entire childhood and adolescence, screaming, hitting, chasing each other with hammers, then I wouldn't be where I am today. After I hung up, I thought about all the times I showed and shrugged the violence in my relationship. It's all right. We just fist fought a little bit and smashed some stuff. Let's put it behind us and move forward. I know we called each other bitches and motherfuckers all night, but that's okay. Let's sweep it under the rug and be nice to each other again. There you go. Like nothing ever happened. See, love isn't supposed to be violent. I'm not a violent person. Tori's not a violent person. Even when we weren't loudly fighting, we were silently resenting each other. We had to end this cycle that my parents handed down to me and that we were now handing down to our kids. Once I had these thoughts, my last rationalization for enduring the marriage was gone. I wasn't saving my kids from a broken home by staying with Tori. The home was already broken. And only by leaving could I fix it. A few days later, I walked out the door with just clothes on my back. I was 30 years old, and my head was finally clear. Keep everything. That's what I told her. I got the rent. I got the bills. I got everything. But we're done. I knew I wouldn't be coming back. Tori knew it too. After all you put me through, you just gonna walk out that door? That's what she said to me. Hey, you may hate me for this today, but tomorrow you'll thank me for it. I'll hate you even more tomorrow. She was right. It definitely took more time than that. Like, I thought the next day she would be okay. She wasn't. I checked into the W Hotel, and I wrestled with my conscience for weeks. I was still racked with guilt and doubt at times, but what helped was spending time with my kids and seeing that I was a better dad to them without the distraction of trying to survive a bad relationship. You can be a great soldier on the battlefield, but you can't be a great father on one. Slowly, over the course of years, we both became ourselves again. We learned to be much better parents, and we continued the process of growing up emotionally that getting into a relationship at such a young age had delayed. The lesson learned from all this is that if you're not careful, your dick can get you into relationships that your head can't fix. But the deeper lesson is that what's important in a relationship is the bricks that every one of your words and actions lays down. Because together they add up. They add up to the home that you're going to live in for quite some time. Brick by brick, I built an unstable house with Tori. One that was doomed to collapse. But the experience enabled us to build great homes afterwards for our kids, our partners, and ourselves. Life lessons from breakthrough. Don't do drugs. Instead, prove everyone who doubted you wrong. It's a bigger high. Now, if this sounds self-centered, that's because it is. I'm a selfish guy. Very selfish, actually. How else would it be possible to write a book this big about myself? You gotta be selfish to talk about yourself for this many pages. But I'm unselfish in giving this to you. I think that made sense. I think I wrapped it up to where it kind of made sense. If I didn't, I don't care because I'm selfish. Chapter 82. I got nothing. Name this one yourself. Whatever you want to call it, you can call it. Your dream is a huge boulder. It takes a lot of effort to get it moving. But if you can budget just a few inches on the right terrain, then it starts picking up speed all by itself. And since Shaq All-Star Comedy Jam, my career had started rolling. My club dates began selling out on a regular basis, so we started stacking two shows a night in most cities. When I performed for 4 days at Caroline's in New York, they had to add the weekend matinees as well. And all 10 shows there sold out. Promoters noticed the number of tickets I was selling, and my booking agent Mike Berkowitz called one day. Now, I know you're not interested in doing package tours, but a lot of offers are coming in. There's a new Kings of Comedy tour they want you on. And they want you on a couple of rap tours. The reason I'm calling is that these offers altogether are worth more than $1 million. Now, when I first heard that, I had to sit down and catch my breath. But then I started thinking, I spent more than 4 years beating up the road to build a personal brand, which I had total control over. I'd formed a brotherhood of loyal and talented friends. I told the guys that if they believed in me and stuck with me through the hard times, I would reward them and take care of them when the good times arrived. I can just throw away my name, my work, my integrity for a big payday. I told Berkowitz to pass on all of them. See, sometimes a good opportunity can still be a backward step. Instead, we decided to make a move that both excited and terrified me. If I was selling out 10 shows at a 250-person capacity club, then I could probably sell out one night at the 2,500-seat theater. So we started testing out theater shows. And although they didn't all sell out, they were successful enough to justify doing more. Every time I waited by the side of the stage to perform on that tour, I had a flashback to standing in the same spot during the Def Comedy Jam tour at the Leacock Center in Philadelphia, promising myself to get my shit together so that one day I could be headlining big venues. I booked the Island Theater in Cleveland to tape the Seriously Funny special. I knew I made progress when I was able to sell tickets instead of giving them away, and I could actually afford the flight there. I was unfortunately traveling lighter than the last time because Tori, who I'd been separated from for almost a year, she wouldn't let me bring Hendrix and Heaven to the taping. Well, I said, what if you come with them? I'm not bringing them no fucking where. This is the only special of mine that my kids miss. Meanwhile, the Cavaliers were there. The Browns were there. Shaq was there. LeBron was there. And I lifted the lid off that theater, dropped a 10-ton thermonuclear device inside, lowered the roof, and then pressed the red button. Boom, bitch! That was me blowing the build. I'm saying boom because that's my impersonation of what I sound like when I'm blowing the building up. Bam! Nah, boom was better. Stick with the boom. Keep the boom in your head. No bam. Boom. You're gonna take the bam out, go with the boom. Maybe I should have did two booms. Boom, boom, bitch! Nah, don't forget it. Just go back. Fuck it. I'm fucking it up. Okay, I'm going back. Okay, people. I've officially ran out of metaphors for good comedy shows, so let's just address that and understand that, because they may decline as the book continues. The metaphors may just keep getting worse. The point behind the booms and the bams of what I'm saying is that a lot of the people laugh a lot of times, is what I'm trying to say. See, man, that don't sound as good. It doesn't make it sound as good as it felt up there on that stage. See, after the show, I rejoined the Plastic Cup Boys and a local promoter backstage, poured myself some tequila, and informed them that I'm about to write another set. We going out again, but this time, we gonna go bigger. They looked at me like I was crazy. Like they needed a break. Oh, we don't rest after success. Fuck that. We don't get comfortable after success. I lifted my red plastic cup up, and I put an arm around the woman I was with. Her name was Eniko. I said, we don't rest. Instead, we raise our goals. We toasted to many more years of brotherhood. Then the promoter asked me, is that your wife? God damn. Shit, man. Just made a fucking toast and you had a... Jesus Christ. Let's just go to the next chapter. Chapter 83. I think I should have just done chapter numbers without titles. It was stupid to try to put titles on all these chapters because I didn't know it was going to be so many of them. I started out the gate really good. I was strong, but I'm losing steam. That's what I'm gonna call it. Chapter 83, losing steam. Hey, Nico, what you want? I'm about to tell you a story of how we met. Remember I was in D.C. at a nightclub after the show on the Seriously Funny Tour and I saw you, but I didn't talk to you? You were wearing like a purple dress. Yeah, we kept running into each other that whole weekend. Next time you saw me, you cracked a joke because my friends and I were taller than you. It was like the most random thing to say, and we would just start laughing. First of all, I'm an attractive man, so I saw that I caught your eye. Did you? That's what you feel. I wasn't even really looking at you. No, I caught you. I caught you looking. I'm not gonna lie, you had a certain charm about you. You did. See, now that would have been the end of it. But on my last night in town, Naeem was meeting up with the girl and the cousin or whatever, so took me along. And guess what, people? Eniko was that cousin. See, it was crazy that the same woman I've been running into for the past 2 days, who I thought was, like, amazingly cute, I actually serenaded the girl. I grabbed the mic in the DJ booth at the dance club, and I just started singing. I'm not gonna lie to y'all, some of the worst singing that I've actually ever heard. But it was silly enough that she smiled because she liked it. She was laughing. After that, we had our little conversation outside. You know, all she would say is that she laughed a lot. I was natural. She was like, this guy's hilarious. So what did I do? You know, I do basically what I'm good at. I just kept telling everybody I'm the funny guy. The funny guy always gets the girl, by the way. That's when me and Eniko exchanged numbers. But afterwards, her girlfriends tried to shit on me. They were like, girl, he married. You don't need to be around him. I actually remember telling Eniko, I was like, on paper, yes, technically, I am married, but you gotta understand that it's not what it looks like. I'm not living at home. She was like, shady. She actually said it like, Shady! It was really good. That was the first time I got to see that she had a little sense of humor. The fucked up thing is that so many women have heard that from men that, of course, they would never believe it. But in this case, it was actually true. So we talked on the phone, man. We Skyped for a couple months after that. And I still wasn't sure. I wasn't sure because she wasn't sure. Like, it was her temperature. She was giving me conversation, but I could tell that she was, like, still just skeptical about my situation. But at the end of the day, people, I'm a sex symbol. My body looks like somebody drew it. Hmm? How could you not be sure about this? I just pulled my dick out. You can't see it because you're listening. But if you were here, you would get to see exactly what I'm talking about. And I don't know if you heard that, but there was a little thud. Because it hit the floor. All right, whatever. I remember Inigo told me that you can't be no sex symbol while you're married. It was like a month or so later. I was in Baltimore, and that's the next time that I saw Inigo. It was just like a quick hi and bye, but we had chemistry, though. We was laughing constantly, you know. Inigo's whole thing was like, I was funny. I wanted her to hang out with me after the show, but she wouldn't do it. She was like, nah, I ain't gonna be a hookup while you in town. I kept trying to explain to her I'm what you call a ladies' man. The ladies know I'm a keeper, so they play that long game. I figured I'd wait it out. You know, whatever. This is new for me, though, because I'm a ladies' man. Meaning that when I see it and I want it, I hops on it. After a few months passed by, Inigo, she came. She met me in Kansas City. To this day, that is one of the most fun days of my life, man. She got on the plane to come see me. I'm not going to lie, dude. I knew for sure that she was interested then. We went to Gates Barbecue. We ate and laughed. I remember at Gates Barbecue, we walked in and all you could hear was the greeting. Like you walked into Gates Barbecue and they go, may I help you? That's the whole thing there. May I help you? May I help you? Maybe it's not the thing. Maybe it was just the lady that was saying it had a aggressive lisp. But that's what we remember. May I help you? We went to the movies. It was like a little high school date. Then I had a show later that night. That was the weekend we hooked up. But when you look back at it, it took a lot of time, man. It was a few months. Her whole thing was like, I don't know what you're used to. I told her what I was used to. I'm used to like, hey, what's going on? You want a drink? Yep. Okay. The next thing you know, bam, 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 bam. That's me hooking up. That's what the bed sounds like. Bam, 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 bam. And then it's over. I used to call myself 4 Bam. Because I'm going to give you 4 Bams, and then it's over. But I had a plethora of those. So you get someone who's different and you vibe with them differently, the other stuff stops mattering as much, and you start thinking about just that one person. But if you let Inigo tell it, she's like, yo, it wasn't that easy. It did take me a little while. It took me a little while to get there. I mean, we're both stepping out of serious relationships, and I had the attitude of, she's definitely moving up to the top of my list, but the last thing I'm going to do is be somebody's man again at this point. Y'all can kiss my ass. I just got out of fucking relationships with the most aggressive ups and downs ever. Kiss my ass. I'm a rolling stone, damn it. Papa was a rolling stone. His dick is in the street, and it's got on track shoes. Meaning that my dick is ready to run. See what I'm saying, guys? I told y'all, I'm running out of them. I'm running out. But I will say this. Out of nowhere, you look up and you find yourself slowly falling into a goddamn relationship. In this particular case, that's exactly what happened. I fell into a relationship by accident. Yeah, I'm thinking about it. That's what happened. Yep, That long pause was me going back to that moment to make sure. And it was definitely an accident. It wasn't on purpose. Chapter 84. The moment I realized that my relationship with Inigo was getting serious was about 7 months after we met. She came to Los Angeles a few times to visit me, and one day we got into our, like, first disagreement. I don't even remember what we were arguing about. But when the time came for Inigo to leave, her eyes started watering, and I thought, oh, God, you don't cry about what you don't care about. With any other woman, this would have been an alarm warning for me to pull back. But it was surprising when I felt moved by a level of emotion instead. I told myself, this here is a good woman, It's time to invest more of myself and my attention in her and see if this can go somewhere. She was gorgeous, black with pieces of Jamaican and Chinese. She had a great sense of humor. I mean, she could hold her own in the green room with the plastic cup boys. She accepted me as I was. She supported my career and touring. And even when we didn't agree on something, we always treated each other with respect. She stepped into the picture at the worst possible time, which was actually the perfect time. My life was in debacle mode. I left my home, I was heading into a divorce, and I was fucking around a lot on the road. But the single life that I missed so much, it got old quickly. It was always the same thing. I think having a variety of women in my bed is going to make life better. This is what being single is all about, right? I got one for Mondays, I got one for Tuesdays, but wait, it's Wednesday. All right, so I got to go through my contacts and find someone. Hey, what are you doing today? You got plans? Huh? Oh, okay. Hey, girl, what you doing? You want to come out and chill? Nope. Oh, okay. What about you? Hey, great. How about you come over? How soon can you get here? An hour later. She looks great, but damn, I mean, talking to her is like, it's like pulling teeth. Let's just take care of business so we don't even have to talk. Bam, 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 bam. Told you guys four bams. It's over, but she's still here. Wait, what time is it? Jesus Christ. Finally, she speaks three magic words. I gotta go. Oh, so soon? All right, okay, I'll see you around. It was sad, guys. And the saddest thing about it was that I had kids. I couldn't be the guy living this life while being a father. There's a reason I never introduced any of those women to my kids. I wasn't even introducing Nico until I knew it was something very long-term. And Nico was also cautious. She refused to put a name on our relationship until I was divorced. 20-year-old Kevin would have hated the idea of taking things so damn slowly. But 30-year-old Kevin was grateful for it. That's how I knew that I was actually growing up. Chapter 85. No, I'm going back to titles. Okay, let's call this one Some More Growing Up. It's some really heavy shit that happened to you growing up. That's what Joey said. He and Harry were at my house for a writing session, which as always was 5% writing and 95% Madden. They had great jobs. You know, when we weren't on the road, they were basically paid to play video games with me. Yeah, man, I agree with Joey when he said it. But the last thing I want is for anyone to feel sorry for me. Because I don't feel sorry for myself. I'm glad for everything that happened to me. Even losing your mom? That's what Harry asked. Seems like you're still hurting over that. Of course I'm hurting over that. I mean, that was tough. They asked about the funeral. It was a sad day, but, you know, since I'm not the type to wallow, I lightened up the story for them and started describing the characters in my family. They kept busting out laughing and every now and then taking notes. It actually looked like they were working during work hours for a second. I ripped on my family, my dad's addiction for a good hour. As I did, I thought, I'm supposed to be a comedian who isn't afraid to bear it all, so why have I been hiding this part of my life? By the time I was done, it was clear to all of us what the follow-up to Seriously Funny would be. Are you really ready to go to these places? Joey asked. I guess. Some of the shit is so funny, man, I couldn't even make it up. The main thing that's important to me with this is that when I leave the stage, people know who I am and what made me. I started popping up for unscheduled spots in New York clubs where I cut my teeth so I could test different stories and approaches. Some nights, there were only 10 people in the audience. Other nights, I do 30 minutes and I wouldn't hear a single laugh. A few times, I saw people on their phones when I was in the middle of talking about my mom's funeral, but I needed the bomb to succeed. I knew that if I could find a way to win over audiences in these tough, cold rooms, then I'd have no problem in a theater packed with people who were actually there to see me. Through talking on stage about subjects, I typically avoided thinking about and receiving the immediate response of laughter, which to me says, I can relate to whatever you went through. I began to heal wounds I didn't know I had. It enabled me to accept even my father's worst behavior and finally go through the grieving process around my mom. Choosing to talk about these deeply personal subjects on what became the Laugh at My Pain tour took me down a whole new road in life. People told their friends to see the show, and those individuals then told their friends. Groups of people came up to me in the street yelling my dad's phrase from the show. All right, all right, all right. Eventually, Mike Berkowitz called. You know, I think that we can add a second theater show in most of these cities. I don't know, man. I want to be patient, Burke. Let's try it. All right, okay. A few months later, Burke called me. Hey, you could probably stop doing theaters and go to basketball arenas in a few of these cities. I don't know, man. Kev, I'm telling you, you can. You sold out 3 nights in Boston. Let's just try it.
Oh, God. Fuck!
Okay. All right, let's do it. The first arena show he booked for us was at the Mohegan Sun Arena in Connecticut, which holds about 10,000 people. As we walked down the loading ramp and through the backstage on the day of the show, I felt like every line of cocaine I'd ever turned down entered my bloodstream. I came on stage with so much damn energy that I had to slow myself down to keep from steamrolling over the jokes. All the work we put in had created momentum. And for the first time, it felt like we couldn't stop the audience from growing even if we wanted to. Our days of flyering were over. At this level, there was a machine working for us. Promoters had a budget for marketing campaigns and radio spots, billboards, print ads, and professional publicists. And I finally had enough money to make one essential addition to the Plastic Cup Boys. John, the only barber who could do my hair right. He left the back chair at Platinum Cuts, joined the makeup artist and the hairstylist guild, and became a permanent part of the team. Beyond the role work, the social media, the specials, and all the other promotions, another factor was probably responsible for this acceleration in my career. I was finally cleaning up the one area of my life where I was a jerk and a hypocrite, and I didn't live up to my own standards. My relationship. Without the guilt, fear, frustration, and resentment running through my mind all the time, I was free to be the best version of myself that I could be. Chapter 86. The one time I got caught cheating without actually cheating. The first time I saw how powerful the media's influence on my life could be was when I took Emiko to a Lakers game. The next day, there were photos online of us holding hands with headlines, "Caught Creeping. Married comedian Kevin Hart bought his jump off the last night's Lakers game." My name had never been on TMZ. I'd never been someone who gossip sites were interested in. I was still so small-time that some of those headlines spelled my name Kevin Heat. Yep. It's a true story. Heat. But my last name is Hart. So the mistake is that they said Heat instead of Hart. That's the joke. Okay. The instant the story broke, Tori was on the phone. "I can't believe you would do this to me."
"Huh?
How dare you humiliate me like that?"
"What? Tori, we separated. The only contact we've had for over a year is about our kids. Do you really think that I'm not doing anything? And if I am, that's not information I need to report to you or anyone else." It was the first time I actually had solid moral ground to stand on with her. Tori, however, no, she felt otherwise. She became malicious in a public way that I'd never experienced before. She attacked me and Nico on social media, on the radio, on E! News. She seemed angrier over this than she'd been about the girl with the snake tattoo. And in a way, it was understandable. Because at this level, our private humiliations were becoming public ones. This was the downside to the fame that I wanted. But I never wanted to be famous as a human being. I wanted to be famous as a human doing. I wanted my shows to sell out, my movies to top the box office, my television shows to get good ratings. I wanted to build on those opportunities to do more and leave my mark on the world through my accomplishments, not my personal life. When I had that thought, I started to laugh. Look at what people make important. Why does anyone give a shit about some comedian's relationship status? If they have nothing better to do, let them talk. I'm going to make the choices that serve my happiness, not their expectations, and that's all that matters. I soon got to the point where I could shoulder shrug it. In fact, the whole situation ended up helping Inigo's in my relationship. When Inigo was dragged in the spotlight and websites were calling her a home wrecker while strangers online called her a bitch, I got to see what her character was made of. Though it was tough for Inigo to deal with, she didn't freak out. She didn't accuse me of ruining her life or take it out on me in any way. She just told me how she felt about it, that it was hurtful, upsetting, overwhelming, and asked for advice on how to deal with it. "Well, are they right or wrong about you?" That's what I asked her. "What do you mean? They're wrong. They're so wrong. And it doesn't matter. We're together, we're smiling, we're happy, and we'll continue to shine because good things grow out of happiness. What do I do about all the emails I'm getting from the media?" "Ignore them. Anything you tell them, they'll blow out of proportion to keep the story going. Stay cool and take the high road. The lies will fade. The truth lasts forever." She nodded, smiled, squeezed my hand. "You're right, babe. Watch what's outside have an effect on what's inside. I like the bubble we're in, and I'm not letting anyone burst it. Back when I was going to dance with Spank, getting lucky meant taking someone home that night. In this moment, I learned what getting lucky really was. Not long after, I asked Eniko to move in so we could be closer and so she could begin a relationship with my kids. Despite all the drama, I never turned my back on Tori. Even when things got ugly, I still remember that she had stayed with me through the hardest times.